KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today is show 200. Show 200 on Hearsay Culture's history going back to May 2006. We're recording this show on December 12, 2013. And as I've mentioned several times over the last couple of months, we were going to do a special show 200, and at the suggestion of several listeners as well as guests, I have acceded to the request that we do a show where I am the interviewee. And it's something that I resisted doing because this is not the Dave Levine show. It is Hearsay Culture, where I focus on the guest rather than me. But there appeared to be some interest, and I haven't done it before. So at that listener and some guest request, we're going to do it. I am thrilled to have Denise Howell from This Week in Law, who was on the show last week, who is going to be my interviewer. She graciously agreed. I'm thrilled to have her here. And so I am going to turn the show over to Denise, who will play the role of me, and it's a role that she plays regularly on This Week in Law, and I will become the interviewee. So, Denise, thank you for joining me at Hearsay Culture, and take it away.
Dave, I'm so honored that you asked me to do this. I'm, in addition to serving as your interviewer today, a huge fan of the show and one of those people who would have loved to have you do this a while back. So it's really nice that on your 200th episode, you've given us the chance to go a bit deeper on who is David Levine, professor at Elon University. And I'm thrilled to be able to facilitate that. And I want to wish you a hearty congratulations on episode 200 of Hearsay Culture. I know from experience that that is a big milestone. And I'm really thrilled that you've made it there and are still going strong.
Thank you so much, Denise, and I'm thrilled to have you here, and I'm excited to have this discussion. It's an unusual and really I haven't done this much from this side of the table, so I'm looking forward to learning from it as well.
Well, you started your show in 2006. It sounds like just a few months before we started doing This Week in Law. So we've been kind of batting around and doing these discussion shows for about the same amount of time. And I was just curious, and I'm sure your whole audience is curious, as to what prompted you to do this. How did you decide to stop practicing and teaching law, or in addition to doing that, also do this sort of episode on a regular basis where you sit back and consider and discuss with people the higher level issues?
So I'll start with the law professor gig. So, you know, I practiced law in New York upon graduating from law school in 98. And I always had an interest in mentorship and in teaching. For starters, it's something I actually did in practice, where as a junior and mid-level associate, I would talk to paralegals and kind of tell them why they were doing the things they were doing. And there were some, not every, but some attorneys with whom I worked who thought that that wasn't necessarily the best use of my time. I wasn't billing that time, I should be clear. I'm not looking to be sued later on for defrauding clients. I did not bill for education, but I really enjoyed it. And I also was always involved in trying to rethink the law. So I was, as a junior and mid-level associate, I was the associate who would often get the assignments that were basically, we have this client, the client has an unusual problem, question, concern. There's no one in the firm that really does this kind of stuff. Who should we ask among the associates to kind of get into the weeds of this weird issue, figure out what the law is, figure out what the problems are, and then go forward? And it was always me, because I kind of enjoyed learning about different areas and getting into the weeds. So by way of example, we had a client who ran into some problems when Enron went south. And the result is that I spent about 3 months learning about the all of the different bizarre financial instruments that Enron created that wound up defrauding a whole host of people, including our client. I was watching hearings of Enron over the summer and those kinds of things, and I loved it. So part of, the big part of why I decided to do what I was doing is that I always was interested in learning a lot of different areas of law. With regard to IP and entertainment in particular, one of the firms with whom whom I worked, Prior Cashman in New York, is a very large, remains a very large entertainment industry firm. And so I did a lot of work for entertainment industry clients and got very familiar with the nuts and bolts of copyright and trademark litigation. But I also started to learn a lot about the policy issues and became concerned about the policy issues, not in the nuts and bolts infringement actions that I was handling as an associate, to be clear, but more on the broader policy issues, fair use and copyright duration and things like that. So I was always looking for opportunities to teach, and I would do alumni panels for Case Western, where I went to law school, and I brought attorneys to conference rooms at the firm to meet with alums and current students to figure out how to get jobs and things like that. But the opportunity arose in 2005 to apply for a fellowship at Stanford. And of course, for someone interested in technology law, intellectual property, the opportunity to work for Larry Lessig is a once in a lifetime thing. And so I applied, and to my shock and amazement, I got a phone call asking for an interview from Jennifer Graddick, who remains not only a mentor but also a close friend. And I did a phone interview with Jennifer and with Lauren Gelman, and I talked to a bit to Larry as well. And the nutshell was, and I will never forget this, in my office, I had since moved to corp counsel in New York City, the phone call from my now wife, Heidi, saying they want you. And I had never been physically to Stanford. In fact, I don't think I had even been to Northern California, but sight unseen, I went. And it was off to the races from there. And, I still consider it an honor to have had that opportunity and to remain affiliated with CIS. Jennifer and Lauren and Larry and Julie Ahrens and Elaine and a whole bunch of people there became friends, and all of whom I'm still very close with and in touch with, and I just feel very grateful for having had that opportunity. The second point with regard to radio, and this is what happens, by the way, on radio shows where I am going, and I'm mindful of time, Denise, so I'm going to try to make this answer quick, although you can follow up as you choose. radio is something I had done going back to high school. I am a graduate of the Ossining, New York public schools, and when I was in high school, we had an FCC-licensed radio station, which sadly no longer exists, but was called WOSS, the Voice of Ossining. And then when I was in ninth grade, as a freshman, I started getting involved in the radio station and spent a lot of time there and worked my way up to being the station manager, the student station manager when I was a senior. I did a talk show on WSS called Inside the NHL, which was a ridiculous name because I had as much inside access to the NHL as anyone who watches a game does. In other words, I had no inside the NHL knowledge, but my buddy and I, Paul, did this talk show where we would talk about the NHL at a ridiculous geeky level. I think we got two calls in a year that we did this. But I was able to do radio there. I did a little bit of radio in college, but then when I started the fellowship at Stanford, and after I was there for a while, I realized that KZSU was across campus, and this was my opportunity to get back in radio, so I contacted the program director and pitched this idea for Hearsay Culture, and they said great immediately. And then when I told them that I had previous experience on high school radio, they were able to move me pretty quickly through the clearance process, and there it was. And so I wound up starting the show in May 2006, and it's been a thrill ever since.
That's so great. So you've had the opportunity to continue going very deep and geeky on specific niche topics as you've gone on with the show.
That's right, yeah. And niche is a good way to put it, because I've always found these areas that certainly have an audience, but we're not always mainstream to talk about.
Well, that's one of the things I think is really interesting about where we are right now, both in the law and in the state of technology. Over the last couple of decades, it seems like we've really seen this amazing opening up of academia and people who used to talk amongst themselves sort of behind closed doors and in ways that were not accessible or transparent to the rest of the world. And now a lot more of those conversations are taking place in public. It seems to me that first with, if you want to go back to the very beginnings of the internet and the first ways that people were reaching out to each other via email, and then via the interactive web, and then as it became more interactive through blogging, and then through other ways to have public conversations, now Google Hangouts and any number of ways to have public participation online, that these ivory tower doors have really opened, and the public has a lot more access to the kinds of discussions and high-level policy considerations that ultimately impacts government than they ever had before. But at the same time, you know, we have this culture of trying so hard in the face of all this transparency and the technologies that enable it, to keep things under wraps and to keep leaks and secrets, keep things secret and prevent leaks. So I'm just wondering, I know you, study that and discuss, the notion of transparency quite a bit. What do you make of the current standoff that we find ourselves in? Do you think that, the people trying to keep things secret and prevent leaks are just in a completely losing battle here, or will there have to be some kind of accommodation made?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, and it is, incidentally, you know, part of the reason why I do the radio show. You know, I'm a firm believer that society improves when information is readily available. And so that's part of why I interview the people that I do, because, you know, I think that their ideas and what they're writing about are important and interesting and should be brought to a wider audience, not just the, you know, the ivory tower or the, you know, the, you know, vacuum chamber or whatever other cliche you want to use of people that are in the weeds of it, but also people that are not, but can learn from them. I find it interesting. You know, the challenge that exists today with regard to information flows is one that I'm still, you know, I don't. Hopefully, I will, but I'm still trying to get my head around. And of course, it's one of the, I think, the great, fascinating and vexing challenges that we have today, which is what are the systems of control of information, and how effective are they? Beyond the broader, even broader question of what information should be accessed. The nature of secrecy is one that, interestingly, has not been studied nearly as much as you might expect, by academics. There's a burgeoning, field of transparency. There's a very lively and robust and growing community of privacy scholars. But secrecy, is one that has kind of been always assumed to be kind of, well, something like privacy, or maybe it is privacy, but it's kind of always assumed, you know, we all have secrets, we all want to keep secrets, sometimes we choose to share information, but as I have learned over the last several years, as I've gotten into, you know, the weeds of secrecy beyond even commercial secrecy, but secrecy more broadly, what I've discovered is there are not a lot of people doing this work. I've tried to have many of these people on Hearsay Culture, and so people like Al Roberts, and Kristen Lord and Susan Marriott and Peter Gallison and Archon Fung. I mean, there are people that are doing this, but it's a very small community as compared to even the transparency community, much less privacy. All of that is by way of saying that, yes, I think there is enormous tension that exists today. You know, I've written about this a little bit, and I'm writing about it more over the next couple of years with projects I have going now. But the nutshell is, you know, the notion that governments, corporations, or even individuals can keep secrets is under attack. And it's under attack in very, you know, very, very clear and manifest ways, like when Julian Assange leaks documents, but also in very subtle ways, like our ability to control what information is out there that we don't even know is there in the first place. And so, you know, the tension is such that, you know, I am very skeptical generally about the ability of any entity, be it government, corporation, group of people, to maintain the kind of secrecy that previously had been possible, and therefore have the kind of benefits that you might expect one to get from secrecy. You know, whether that means that policymakers and individuals should no longer conceive of secrecy as something that's possible, I think is going too far. But to apply secrecy now in 2013 the same way that we did in 2003 even, I think is a big mistake.
as you were talking, I just could not get out of my head the vision from the old TV series Get Smart and the cone of silence and how governments just need, you know, something that they can pull down to cloak around themselves. But I'm afraid that the technology available to them is probably about as dated as the technology that was featured in that humorous TV show.
No, I think that's right. You know, you think about, you know, all of the ways that, you know, even, and this is not even, as great a reference as yours, but just, you know, in the various iterations of James Bond, right? Mm-hmm. From the earliest days, I put aside James Bond's exceptional misogyny, and all of those other reasons that you might be skeptical about James Bond as a franchise, but the technology that you see there, right? From his most, you know, biggest films where you have, in Gold Finger, the famous scene where Bond, you know, sneaks into a room. Of course, you know, the room has, because it's a James Bond film, right, a scantily clad woman doing the bidding of a man, which, of course, is the James Bond franchise. But again, putting all of the misogyny aside, right, James, you know, she is watching through binoculars a secret, right? She's watching this guy who's playing cards and looking at the cards from the back to feed information to Goldfinger, the evil villain who's fixing a card game, right? All of these secrets that exists. I mean, in this case, right, what you needed to have binoculars and there's a tape recorder. And in the early 1960s, this was major technology. And, of course, you know, it's almost laughable now. And yet, right, the notion then, and this goes back literally into Hebrews of the Old Testament, the ability of individuals to have secrets that they don't share with others, right, has been at the core and remains at the core of what makes us human. And the moment that those challenges occur, you know, it's not surprising that everyone from the U.S. Trade Representative and the White House to individuals really have no idea what information they can hold dear and what they can't.
Right. Well, there are two issues there, what they can hold dear and what they should, right? So let's take this to something concrete that you've been doing a lot of work with lately, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has been attempted to be crafted and negotiated and finalized behind closed doors. And finally, at least portions of it leaked out into public view and have been subject to debate and criticism. So there, the cone of silence didn't work. Yeah, right. A leak took place. And I think this is probably one of the biggest considerations that lawmakers are having to struggle with and diplomats today is, you know, not only how can we keep things secret, but to what extent is it even appropriate? You know, obviously there are some benefits to be gleaned by being able to get things done in a direct, you know, non-public conversational way. Yet there is certainly the countervailing notion that on degrees of international importance, there is a role for public participation and comment as important things get decided, hopefully not all behind closed doors. So on November 14th, just last month, you spearheaded a letter to the President, Congress, and Ambassador Michael Froman about the TPP and about the need for more transparency there. Can you tell us first the thrust of the letter and secondly the reasons for your decision to pursue it?
Sure. And I should say, by the way, you are listening to KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, where Denise Howell of This Week in Law is interviewing me, Dave, who normally is the interviewer, for those of you that are thinking you're in an alternative universe. So the nutshell, Denise, is this, and this is, you know, this is, I think, a very challenging but critically important procedural question in lawmaking. As you mentioned, and those that have listened to the show, both your show, I know you had Mike Geist on recently, and others who have talked about TPP in my show, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, this vast, multilateral trade agreement that has a wide variety of substantive areas, including intellectual property, has been negotiated for the most part in secret. And I say for the most part because there have been, in fact, there's a call tomorrow. Again, the show's being recorded on December 12th. There's a call tomorrow that the U.S. Trade Representative has offered where there will be some sort of briefing of stakeholders. others. But so there is some information that gets out there, but the core of the information, that is what is the actual text of the agreement, remains officially secret. You know, as you mentioned, the letter that Sean Flynn and I wrote, and that was signed terrifically, was signed by over 80 law professors, focused on the fact that as it stands today, after 19 rounds, we the public do not have access to that actual information. And what that means is, right, given the scope of the topics, right, topics including virtually all of the areas in intellectual property that we talk about in hearsay culture, that patent infringement, generic medicine, copyright infringement on the internet, issues involving things like what the equivalent of Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but technological protection measures on the internet, and you can go down a list, are all being negotiated by these countries, the United States and several other countries around the world. And in a nutshell is, we don't know what's there. And so the letter was a call, even at this late date, after 19 rounds and 4-odd years of negotiations, for the U.S. Trade Representative to do what at this point seems to me an obvious thing to do, which is to make the negotiating text public. And what that does is get more voices in the room. And by more voices, I mean a diverse range of interests. As it stands now, the only entities that really have the detailed access of what's being negotiated are members of an advisory council the acronym is ITAC, Industry Trade Advisory Council, but the commission. But the nutshell is that it's made up of basically representatives of the entertainment and pharmaceutical industries, and those are the only entities through this administrative process that actually see the negotiating text. Now, it's not entirely clear how they see it or how often they see it, but they definitely, as far as we understand, which is again part of the secrecy, have this access. Meanwhile, right, everyone from civil society groups to interested citizens, academics, and you can go, and even to a large extent members of Congress themselves, have not had that same access. Okay? And so, you know, if you think about how law is made in Congress and the notion that there would be a bill introduced in Congress dealing with copyright infringement, take SOPA and PIPA as a classic example of this, and imagine SOPA and PIPA being a bill that was being negotiated in Congress in secret by members of Congress and Hollywood and the pharmaceutical industry only, and that would only be made available at the last minute before a vote occurred. That effectively appears to be what the USTR is attempting to do, which causes enormous problems.
Is there a difference, though, between things that are going on specific to the United States lawmaking process and things that affect countries and their dealings with each other internationally? Is there any higher interest in secrecy in the latter case?
So that is one of the great questions here, and that's what makes this issue not as cut and dried as it appears. And this is something that frankly, over time, as I've thought about it more, I've developed, I think, I would say more nuanced, some would say more conciliatory, but I don't think that's necessarily the case, view of the situation. Because the answer is yes, right? I mean, there are clear differences, right? The U.S. Trade Representative is an entity that is conceived to be a representative of U.S. trade interests. Now, problem number one, and this is something that Margot Kaminsky is writing about, it's an important point. The U.S. Trade Representative is there to represent what are considered to be the business interests of the United States. Now, part of the problem is that I think the definition of what the business interests of the United States are is ridiculously narrow right now. So to be clear, this ITAC, this commission, or this advisory council for the USTR and intellectual property, does not include entities like Google. Okay, and Google obviously has a few IP interests as far as I know. So you've got a very narrow definition of what's there. But the larger problem is, and what are you referring to, is that this is not a negotiation taking place at the domestic level. It's taking place at the international level. And so the interest, obviously, of countries like Japan, of countries like Australia, countries like Bahrain, okay, and Singapore, and there's a number of other countries that are doing this negotiation are obviously quite different than that of the United States. All of these countries are at the table because obviously they see a benefit in entering into a trade agreement with the United States and with the other signatory countries. But of course, the United States is the big player in the room, and they are, through a variety of negotiation methods, trying to get what the U.S. considers to be in its best interest into this agreement. Those interests do not always square with the other negotiating countries, but nonetheless, those countries are in the room, and they have to, or they're trying to, work out an agreement. The challenge becomes, right, in the context of an international lawmaking, that is the United States conception of what should be public and what should be public in, say, Bahrain, is quite different. And those countries may not have, and often do not have, at least on the books, the same interest in having information made public as others. And so, you know, you take a negotiation between the United States and Malaysia, which is occurring in TPP. And Malaysia obviously operates in a very different way than the United States does. And so if Malaysia is going to take a position in TPP that is one that might be controversial domestically, in other words, there may be opposition to it in Malaysia, the Malaysian negotiators may have an interest in seeing that information not be made public. At the same time, so there are differences, and the differences become literally what those countries feel that they can and cannot do in negotiation if their domestic constituencies are concerned. But there's a flip side to that, and which is why even that argument I don't think holds as much water as it sounds. Because the fact of the matter is, and I base this on partially a lot of research, but also my own experience, I was a legislative aide in the New York State Assembly after I graduated from undergrad, and I would posit that the challenges of publicity in making law in Albany or making law in New York State certainly are comparable to the challenges of publicity that would occur at the international stage. Because the fact of the matter is that while, you know, you, Denise, and I and others that are focused on this issue may be very concerned and very interested in the terms of these agreements are incredibly complex. And it takes an enormous, and this is not to say that it doesn't make one smarter if they can do this, it just means they put the time in. But the fact is that you're not going to just open up WikiLeaks draft of the TPP chapter, IP chapter from a few weeks ago and read and say, oh yeah, I understand that. You could understand it, right? But you'd have to put a lot of time and effort into it. Here's my point. The people that are generally interested in these topics are the same people that are going to be calling up in the USTR tomorrow to have the stakeholder briefing. And they're talking to each other. And so the notion that the agreement's going to be killed because everyone in the United States sees the draft to me seems ludicrous, because there aren't that many people who are going to bother reading it. That is not, by the way, apathy. I'm not suggesting that the public is apathetic. I'm merely suggesting that even though these issues are critically important to all of us, because literally, to be clear, and it sounds like hyperbole, but it is not, that agreement, the TPP agreement, will impact, if it comes into force, everyone that uses the internet. Okay, and impact directly in terms of the kinds of information you might have access to and what you might be liable for. But at the same time, the people who would actually offer useful input, which is lacking, and that's the key here, are very few. And so I've been pushing, not just in this letter, but personally, to simply offer this. My understanding is that one person at the RIAA, at the Recording Industry Association of America, and the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, has this access to the negotiating text, okay? I have proposed that if that's the case, why not have one person from the Electronic Frontier Foundation have that same access? Right, just one, right? In other words, level the playing field for the whatever the opposite number is of the RIAA and MPAA in order to have that input process occur. And it's sadly, there's been no response to these kinds of suggestions. So it's the failure to allow for balanced, meaningful input that is at the core of the process here. And I think it's undemocratic. I think it leads to imbalanced law. Yes, it is true, and I certainly try to reveal as much as is possible possible following Lessig's model of disclosure and revealing your biases? Absolutely. I am, on a substantive level, very concerned about the terms in TPP. In fact, Sean Flynn and I had a op-ed piece in the Daily Journal in California on Friday about the substantive concerns, and so it is absolutely true that my conception of what IP law should look like is very different than that of Hollywood and the pharmaceutical industry, at least as represented in USTR. But my point is that the process isn't open to even get to a balance. And so long as you don't have the ability to offer that meaningful input, you're not going to have the ability to create, I think, better balance and, by the way, democratically legitimate law. What I'm going to do, Denise, as I take the reins just for one moment at the bottom of the hour here, is do a quick public service announcement for KZSU. So this is really odd for me, so I'm putting on the hat of the advocate, the professor, the host. But KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu. So I hand it back to you, Denise. And thanks again. We're Denise Howell is our guest host today, interviewing me, Dave Levine, on Hearsay Culture. Denise?
Well, you may have just answered my next question, but I want to be clear in my own mind whether you did. And that is whether you've gotten a positive response to the November 14th letter and any kind of action that may occur as the result of your advocacy and that of the other law professors that joined with you.
Yeah, so I've gotten, I have gotten some feedback, and my sense is that there is a growing recognition that the level of secrecy around TPP has gone too far. By way of example, and this show is going to air actually on December 18th, so this would have already happened, but I'm going to be chatting with Move On. And I'm not a member of Move On, and I haven't been involved in their activities, but they contacted me based upon the letter to hear more about this issue. As I've told anyone that asks, I am willing to talk to anyone that has an interest in these issues, because to be clear, my primary concern about TPP is procedural, that we need to have the expert voices representing a wide variety of interests and expertise at the table to make the law. And so, the opposite of Move On would be if the Tea Party contacted me, I'd talk to them too. This is a very important procedural question. But my sense is that there is a growing recognition across a wide variety of constituencies that the secrecy at this point is counterproductive. The political challenge is an interesting one now, because of course Julian Assange having now leaked an additional document over the last week on top of the main document, the chapter from mid-November, of course creates classic war of attrition. So if the USTR now formally releases a document, Julian Assange of WikiLeaks will, be able to relatively easily argue that they forced that issue to happen. In other words, they forced the USTR's hand. And of course, this turns to issues literally of national security, because Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, while they may have been, I think they, it was a good thing that they released this information to the public, they have also released information to the public that is detrimental to the interests of the United States. I am very concerned and troubled when I see diplomatic cables where you have diplomats working in good faith to attempt to resolve highly volatile situations have their cables released to the public. To me, and Steve Aftergood at the Federation of American Scientists made this point better than I did a few years ago when Manning's 250,000 cables were made public, but he effectively said, if the goal of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange is to create peace, they're not doing it. In fact, he said that isn't their goal, because you don't help diplomatic efforts when you take these very sensitive diplomatic negotiations and make them public. So I am not the term that's being used now is, radical transparency. I am not one of those people. But having said that, there is no question in my mind that after 19 rounds of negotiations, and particularly, incidentally, where you have an impasse, as appears to exist in a number of areas in the IP chapter, why you wouldn't try to resolve that impasse by bringing more voices to the table who can come up with solutions is simply beyond me. So that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, I think there is a growing recognition, even in constituencies that didn't previously comment on this, that this is a problem.
Well, it seems to me, and I can't purport to be able to channel Julian Assange or speak for anyone at WikiLeaks or for that mindset, but it seems to me that one of the goals of what they do, or one of the driving forces behind it, is a lack of patience with notions of diplomatic sensitivity, a sort of attitude that, you know, get over it. If Bahrain has certain things they're trying to keep from their constituents, tough luck, because this is the world as it exists today. Technology and human nature are going to constantly collude together to make sure that diplomatic sensitivity aside, information gets out. And governments and lawmakers and negotiators are just going to have to live with that and learn to deal with the pushback that they'll get while they are attempting to get things done. And I'm just wondering if you think that that's a valid perspective, or that there needs to be recognition that there's a role, even in today's world with today's technology, to keep things under wraps.
So, you know, it's a great question, Denise, because, you know, I don't mean to suggest that we shouldn't, as I said earlier on, rethink the role of secrecy. And in an ideal, I think it is a relatively ideal situation, but one that I don't think we've reached either procedurally or substantively or physiologically, to say mm-hmm. that any information that an individual needs in order to have happiness should be made available to them. You know, and so there is, you know, a larger question that Julian Assange, in his way, has forced us to ask, which is the question you asked at the beginning. What information do we actually need to know? The problem with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, as you alluded to, is that it's a blunt instrument. That as far as we know, right, there's very little that WikiLeaks gets its hands on that it doesn't make public. Now, you know, they enter into arrangements with journalists who, of course, you know, are in a position, given their responsibilities and duties, to report the news. But even they, too, operate under a slightly different code of ethics and understandably at times have not made public what apparently WikiLeaks has its hands on. But, you know, the notion that there is no longer a role for keeping information from the public when the public has an interest, I don't think that's where we are yet. Mm-hmm. And so by way of example, you know, when we're talking about something like TPP, at its core, putting aside all the jargon and acronyms and references, we're talking about making law, right? We're talking about lawmaking. And lawmaking conceived in 2013 and for centuries has been one, at least at the broadest notion, where you have debate and discussion. Now FOIA, right, the Freedom of Information Laws, at least in the United States, only go back about 50 years. So the notion that the public actually has a right to this information is a relatively new one. But having said all of that, you know, I think, and this is where technology plays a huge role, and you've alluded to, you know, this as well in your discussions on This Week in Law at length. You know, the need for information now immediately, and that gratification undoubtedly puts pressure on lawmakers to have that lack of patience themselves, that I think you correctly point out Julian Assange does as well. And so, you know, it's an interesting way to think about this problem as one of wanting things to happen more quickly than they do. You know, at its core, however, with Julian Assange, right, you know, I think he is, to the extent that he's written about it and said it, I think he's right. Because it's hard not to be cynical about a lot of the decisions that are made on these important issues, in lawmaking bodies. But when you feed into that concern and exacerbate it when you keep information secret for far longer than its utility. And the USTR, in my view, and I wrote this recently on InfoJustice, on American University's InfoJustice blog, Julian Assange is now in control of when information is made public, and the USTR has only made him stronger. And that, to me, just is like I said, is mind-bogglingly short-sighted, and I think reflects primarily what scholars call pathway dependence. This is how we've always done it, and this is how we will continue to do it.
What do you think, we're talking about sort of government privacy and secrets, how do you think this translates to the personal level and people's attitudes towards transparency versus secrecy and or privacy in their own data and information? I was just reading an article that Instagram is having a service that now lets you share photos privately like Snapchat, and there seems to be, a demand in the marketplace. Not that this would be an ultra secure communication that would keep the prying eyes of, say, the NSA out of the communications, but it would keep communications off the greater web and give people a higher degree of certainty that this conversation that they want to have with a few people might only be seen by that select group of people. Do you think that at the beginning of the show, we were talking about how the internet opened things up and made so much more public. Are we now seeing people try and figure out ways to put the lid on that?
I think there is, there is a slow but steady backlash against, this radical transparency applied to individuals. We've seen that in the, uproar every time Facebook changes one of its settings. And of course we see it now, at least among an interesting group of people, with regard to, NSA's, spying. But I think what's most interesting is, actually the lack of uproar, that it seems like a lot of people, right? It seems like a majority of the users of the internet kind of view a lot of what's going on as the price of doing business, which has, of course, been the argument that's been made by, purveyors of social networking technology from the beginning. This is not a gift to society. This is a business. And the price of doing business is, for example, if you use Facebook, that your personal information will be monetized. And if you don't want it monetized, at least by Facebook, don't join Facebook. What I found most surprising is the lack of uproar, generally speaking, about a lot of these issues. I would have thought that the revelations that are coming out, weekly or, at this point, maybe monthly at this point, as a result of the Snowden documents, would have caused far more outcry than they have. And I think part of that, and I think it's a challenging question, and Al Roberts was just on a couple of weeks ago discussing his book, The End of Protest, where he's looking at these kinds of questions as well. Why is it that there isn't more concern? So I guess because I don't want to filibuster, and we're getting, by the way, I'll do this, the unfair portion of the show. We have about 10 minutes left, but you're in charge, Denise, so go ahead and ask me unfair questions. The real challenge or question we have is whether people are accepting, if they're accepting what's going on, why is that happening? Or is it still the case, and I still think this is possible, that a lot of people simply don't realize how much of their privacy and of their information is no longer theirs to control?
Yeah, that's, I don't know the answer to that question either. I think it's probably, it varies from person to person how much people pay attention to that issue or have just ceded control to others. Okay, so if we're getting into the last 10 minutes of the show and the unfair portion of the show, I don't know if this is unfair, but I feel that given the fact that you are a professor and we're grading exams just this morning of your students, as a public service to them, I thought I'd try and get some insights into the person that is controlling their destiny and also sort of the state of the legal profession and, mm-hmm. and the future of your students. So let's start out with the exams that you're grading and your take on how kids in law school, or not everyone who goes to law school is obviously a kid. Anybody seems like a kid to me who's under the age of 30 these days. how they can increase their chances of doing well in your class. Professor Levine.
thank you, Denise. Yeah, so, you know, yes. Literally to my right is a stack of exams that my contract students did on Tuesday. And so I have begun grading them. It is all blind, and I want everyone to know that I have not taken, I've not overdosed on any medications. I don't have bourbon next to me. So I am doing this with full capacity, at least my full capacity to do it. I'll answer your question directly because it's an important one. Of course, my answer, in part is going to reflect the, systemic challenges that legal education and the law profession is facing right now. At the core level, right, it's about, first and foremost, it's about preparation. And that has not changed in the history of practice, right, in the history of most professions. I had a partner for whom I worked at Prior Cashman, used to point this out regularly, and I was amazed that this partner, Don Zacharin, would prepare for trials in a way that was just remarkable. And he would get files, and he, I remember him telling me, your best work will be done by knowing the ins and outs of all of the facts in these files. And he was absolutely right. And so what I try to do in my classroom first is make sure that the students have the skills necessary to practice law. And that means attention to detail. And so I teach contracts, which for those that aren't lawyers is a first year course. So every law school in the United States teaches contracts among their first year courses. And then I also teach, obviously, intellectual property, internet law. I teach a course in trade secrets. And I've taught civil procedure as well. But the nutshell is, at how do you do well in my class? First and foremost, you come prepared. Now, I tell my students, and I borrowed this line from Mary Rose Papandrea, who is a professor at Boston College, and she tells her students, and I say this sincerely, and I preface it by saying I don't mean to sound obnoxious when I say this, but she says, if you come prepared, I can help you say something intelligent. And that's an important thing, particularly to tell first-year law students who, if they're anything like I was, are scared that they're going to not sound at all intelligent as they work through these issues. So first is preparation. Secondly is, along those lines, right, the ability to keep an open mind. It is critically important that for lawyers and for law students that they take arguments and counter-arguments seriously. And this is something, again, that I do on the radio show. In order to understand different positions, you need to take those positions seriously, even if your visceral reaction is that this is absurd. You cannot be a decent attorney, much less a great attorney, if you have a fixed mind and a closed mind with regard to arguments. And so I force my students through our discussion in class to take seriously counter-arguments. What are those arguments? And then we can critique them. But if you don't take them seriously, you can't. And lastly, and this is also, part of it, is professionalism. The ability of, students today to recognize what proper behavior is and what isn't. And this is always, this has always been a challenge for our youth. And so part of it is literally modeling. This sounds paradoxical, but I call my students by, not by their first name, but by their last, Mr. and Miss. And part of it's not because, of formality as much as it is because of line drawing. I tell my students, and I am active on Facebook, I am not their friends, and I'm not going to be their friends, and if they want to be my friend, they can be my friend after they are handed a degree, and then it's their choice, because I think it's critically important pedagogically to keep those lines drawn. Now, that's not the view of all professors, and there are certain benefits to having a more personal relationship with students, but my personal view is that it is plenty of work for us to teach attorneys to be attorneys, and my preference for doing that is to maintain those lines.
Do you feel like the economy over the last few years has shaken out the people who used to go to law school just sort of by default because they didn't have another life plan in front of them, and law just seemed like something that they could do for 3 years and have a degree and maybe practice, maybe do something else. Do you feel like the fact that the profession has become more challenging and competitive has left you with students who actually have a passion for some aspect of the law?
You know, that's another great question. And Denise, I'm going to say it again. I'm so thrilled you're doing this because I'm such a fan of what you do on This Week in Law, and you're doing exactly what I expected and hoped, and I'm thrilled. These are great questions. So now that I've, and it's always good to butter up the interviewer. That's always a nice tactic, incidentally, for those of you that are going to be on the show in the future. I think we're starting to see that now. You know, there's been a bit of lag time, I think. The economic downturn that occurred in 2008, roughly, really, I don't think hit law schools until about 2010 or even 2011. And so, the well-known drops in application numbers that have hit all law schools have created a situation, at least my sense is, that there are, in fact, more students coming in the door who have thought very carefully about, let's be clear, the debt that they're taking on and the time that they're putting in, but primarily it's the financial debt that they're taking on by being lawyers. I think it is true, and I only started on the tenure track in legal teaching in 2007, so I don't have the institutional knowledge. But even from 2007, there definitely seems to be a greater concentration of people who are serious about what they're doing. And what that means is, right, I mean, what it means for the classroom is an interesting one. My experience this semester, and I guess I should say, this show being airing on December 18th, at that point, my plan is that my grades will have already been turned in, so no one will be getting any further insight into what my grades are going to look like, at least from this current semester. But the nutshell is this. You know, the students I had this semester, by and large, were very engaged, and it's not that they haven't been engaged in the past, but I definitely noticed that there is a seriousness of purpose in the students, which I think is commendable, and it's something that you need to have as a lawyer. But I think it's because they are taking, at least as it stands today in December 2013, more of a risk than they appeared to be taking 5 years ago. I don't think it's false optimism. We're already seeing signs that things are turning around. The value of a JD is one that has been largely forgotten from the standpoint of what you can do with your JD other than practice law. And while that sounds like a salve, in other words, you know, it's an excuse, well, there are no legal job, so, you know, people can do something else. That was certainly a reason why I went to law school. I didn't, frankly, plan on practicing law as long as I did when I went, and teaching was something I would have loved to have done, but quite frankly, didn't think I'd have the opportunity to do, for a few reasons. But the nutshell is, I was thinking I'd go back into government. I was a legislative aide in the New York State Assembly, and my plan was to go right back into government and use my JD and my legal reasoning skills to work on writing better law. Because I was concerned about how law was being written even then. Of course, now I'm teaching and I'm thrilled doing it. It's a wonderful job. And, as a friend of mine says, grading is probably the only thing you should be paid to do, as a law professor. And I feel that way. And grading's not so bad. It's just, in a job like this, it is the hardest thing to do. So I feel very fortunate and very blessed. But with regard to, teaching, and where we are in the profession, I think students are showing a seriousness of purpose, now that appears to be more pronounced earlier in their legal education.
All right. Well, I think we've gotten to know a good deal more about Professor David Levine and the views and important issues that he brings with him in doing this great show. It's been a great honor to be able to bring out some of that information here today. And again, just congratulations on the wonderful work that you do here, David, and the continued success of your show.
Denise, thank you so much for doing this. It's been really a lot of fun to be on, proverbially on this side of the microphone. Like I said, you did a great job, and I'm a huge fan of your show. I mean, this is backslapping that we're doing, but I mean it sincerely. I thank you so much for doing this and doing it. I should note, out of a very busy schedule and your own schedule, where doing your show weekly. So thank you so much for being here. And of course, we will continue our interactions, but thanks for a great interview.
It's my pleasure.
So I wanted to mention on show 200 here, as I close, a couple of quick thank yous and reflections. As with everything that one does, we don't operate, at a solo level. I mentioned early on and first, I thank greatly, Larry Lessig and Jennifer Granick, and Lauren Gelman, and others, at CIS who frankly, hired me where they could have hired anyone for the opportunity to do the fellowship at Stanford. It goes without saying, but it always bears repeating that I my wife and my sons are huge supporters, my parents, but professionally, first, Larry and Jennifer and Lauren gave me an opportunity that has enriched my life and something that for which I am eternally grateful. In addition, with regard to the radio show, I don't do this enough, honestly, thanking the people at KZSU who consistently have put the show on the air. And let me be clear about this, because I don't think I ever have been entirely clear about it. So I record the show, as many of you know, from Greensboro, North Carolina, because I teach full-time at Elon. But through the magic of servers, it is downloaded over in Palo Alto at Stanford by people at KZSU who then sit at the board and make sure that the show goes on the air. These people, to be clear, are volunteers. And so the various program directors, Mark Lawrence, who is the chief engineer over at KZSU, who literally built that station, as well as the DJs over the years who have manned the board, I am eternally grateful to them as well, because the show wouldn't be on the air without their efforts. In addition, at CIS, Joe Nito, who AV specialist at Stanford, and now Elaine Adolfo, take that show and post it and put it on Stanford servers so that it can be downloaded as a podcast. And so I am grateful to them for their work. And I should also mention, and this I have mentioned on the air, Hearsay Culture has been the subject of very sophisticated hackers who have hacked the website repeatedly over the last several years and turned it into a Viagra and Cialis spam server, literally. And I do not nearly have the coding expertise to handle this issue, but Oliver Day, who was a guest on the show, volunteered and put in hours and hours and hours of time combating this very sophisticated attack. And literally, without Oliver, hearsayculture.com would have, at one point, was at least there was a warning in Google that it was a spam site, but it would have been taken down entirely. Of course, last and most important, I thank the guests and the listeners. I've had the privilege of having so many wonderful guests on over the last several years, who have not only, of course, enriched my understanding of society and technology and law, but also I think have given enormous value to the listeners themselves. And so for them and their time, it's something that I can't repay. And the listeners who are that I hear from time to time, and who I talk to, who enjoy the show. I consider it a privilege and an honor to do this show. I will continue to do it so long as CIS and or KZSU would like me to do it. And as far as I know, I haven't received any warning letters yet, so I think we'll continue doing it. So again, it is a privilege to do the show. I've enjoyed it tremendously. I look forward to another 200 shows, and I look forward to continuing our discussion on Hearsay Culture. So please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and we will reconvene at the beginning of the winter quarter in January 2014. So enjoy the rest of the holiday season. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and I will talk to you on the new year.